Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Before we get started with Brendan and KVV, I'd like to talk about our PGA Championship sponsor, Greater Than. I highly recommend everybody give this stuff a shot. It's tastes great, and it is really way better for you than the traditional long-standing sports drinks on the market. It has less sugars, less calories, and twice the electrolytes. Try out GT at drinkgt.com and use the promo code THEFRIEDEGG with no spaces to get 20% off your first order. If you love Greater Than already, ask your golf course or club to stock it. Now, without further ado, here's our PGA Championship Recap Podcast with Brendan and Kevin.
The fried egg requires a different technique. What you need to do is actually square the face so it'll dig down underneath that bad lie and propel that ball right out onto the green.
Here's the thing. Playing out of a buried lie in a bunker is completely different than playing out of a nice, clean lie in a greenside bunker.
You need to be aggressive on any shot, whether it's sitting cleanly or it's a fried egg.
Well, we've all faced it, the dreaded fried egg. It's not to be feared, though. It's actually a pretty easy shot to hit.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. I am joined by Brendan Porath from SB Nation and Kevin Van Valkenburg from ESPN. Guys, welcome on.
Andy, thanks for having me.
Andy, great to be here. The third time back. I'm the Brooks Koepka of the Fried Egg Podcast.
Yeah, three in a row here. What a tournament.
It was awesome. I mean, I think we all predicted that it was going to be a good leaderboard, but man, couldn't have predicted this. I think we thought maybe Tiger was going to miss the cut, and that certainly didn't happen, did it?
Not at all. I mean, it was, am I wrong in saying like Thursday and Friday really kind of lacked juice? Like, I don't know. Like, I thought like we were kind of like, wow, this really stinks. The course has really been poured on, and like, you know, the coverage, we can't watch anything. It's just, we get, of course, Twitter demands the thought of the exact moment. That's really rarely a holistic 10,000 foot view. But, I think it's just the latest lesson in kind of like chilling out and waiting for things to happen, unfold.
I know that Brooks Koepka was not happy that no one wanted to talk to him about his one under 69. heard all about that from Claude Harmon yesterday, about how disrespectful that was to the U.S. Open champion. I'm like, all right, guess what? I'm going to request you at every single major from now on, and you're going to tell me your thoughts on the course. It's real fun to hear you after you shoot 74 someday.
I do think that picture that Joel Beal posted of the press conference for Koepka, that's amazing. I mean, there was like five people in there.
Yeah.
Which, well, he doesn't say anything, though.
They do these, like, these Tuesdays are just every 20 minutes, they're bringing in a new guy. And there's only, like, you know, we live in a universe of unlimited content. But, there's like, there might actually be limits, you know, Brooks Koepka on a Tuesday, it's just the limit after Tiger and all these people. Like, I'm sorry, he doesn't, you know, now, of course, we have a different view. He's a three-time major winner. But he just, like, you can't have it both ways where, you know, the media doesn't want to talk to me. And then when the media talks to you, you're kind of like a brusque dickhead and you don't give them anything to work with. You know, it seems like, you know, I actually liked his press conference after the win last night. And I think it was a question from you, Kevin. He really, he had to think about becoming one of the all-time greats. And he smiled and it like actually, you actually saw something kind of working up there.
Yeah,
and
I think we're bros now. Yeah.
I think he kind of wanted to give like a legit answer. Like, and he said he likes golf and these next few years are going to be awesome. But, like, I think it's hard to have it both ways. That photo, like, those Tuesdays are madness. Like, you can't just sit in that press conference room all day. You have work to do. There are things to do. And I guess Kep could just draw the short straw at the wrong time, and he was at near the end of the day. That's just how it happened. But it was not the most It was kind of an indicting photo for the press.
Look, if you compare yourself to the Tiger press conference, you're never gonna like be okay with like how things work out, because like every local TV station there wants to get the Tiger clip on the St. Louis News, and you know you just have to kind of accept that it's different. I mean, it's different for Rory. Like, there's not that many people. There's more people in the Rory press conference, but that's because Rory could say something really, you know, interesting and insightful. And maybe Brooks could do that, but, you know, I haven't heard it yet in the presser from him. And I think it's just because he's not entirely like that kind of person who wants to give that to himself. It's sort of a be careful what you wish for kind of thing. Like,
all right, we're getting this back on the tracks. No more press conference talk. Let's talk about what happened. You know,
yeah, you brought up the photo.
Well, you know, I didn't want it to divulge into like a 5-minute discussion of press conferences. We got to get back on topic here. Tiger Woods shot 130 on the weekend and lost.
Yeah.
Like, and it wasn't like, I never felt like he was going to win.
I felt briefly like when he almost dunked that wedge on 15 that he could win. That was the one moment where I was like, man, like this is, even though it was coming off kind of a deflating bogey, just felt like there was a lot of rumors that Adam Scott had made a double. And so we were all like, oh man, it's just Brooks and Tiger in that moment. And so that was the one moment I was like, maybe he's going to come to 17. If he hits that bomb cut that he's been hitting up there, he's going to have a really good chance of hitting this close in two. And, you know, it kind of deflated after that.
Yeah, there was one moment. I allowed myself to think he was going to win yesterday. I don't know that I did at the Open, even when he held the lead. It just felt like at the Open there were still too many names. It was too crowded. Whereas yesterday I felt like all he needed was something for Brooks to, you know, he's just relying on a Brooks collapse, which, you know, was highly unlikely as we've seen. He's a machine. But, you know, there was that moment where he had two bogeys in a row, and I think on the sixth he needed like a pretty lengthy save coming back up after he blew it past the hole. Like, I just felt like he had shown signs of maybe giving a shot or two back to the field coming in. And as Tiger, again, at 15, like when the ball was in the air and it literally almost went in the freaking hole, it just felt like something special was happening. Even in like the putter race on 13, I went and did the like Photoshop comparison with 86 Necklace. I never tweeted it because I was like, oh, this will be like all takes exposed or something terrible. It's like he did the putter race on 13 and then, you know, they made the bogey. It came back on 15. I was like, there is this might be like, even with Brooks Koepka being the way he is, this might be like something bigger than him and something might be happening. I allowed myself to think he could have won yesterday.
Let me rattle down from 13 on. This is, you know, Brooks Koepka birdie looks. 7 feet, 6 inches, 6 feet, 8 inches, 11 feet, 5 inches, 10 feet, 6 feet, 7 inches. He was 104 feet and 3 inches and two on 17. So I think he had like 6 feet, 4 inches on 17 and for birdie. Yep. And then on 18, he had his longest birdie look of 17 feet on the last 7 holes. Like, that is just dominance.
The drives too. I mean, the drive on 15 was like 340. And then the 4-iron to 6 feet. And then the drive on 17 was, I was standing right behind him. It was unreal. I mean, it was murdered. And then his drive on 18 was murdered. It was like, that was what Tiger used to be. Like, a guy who just absolutely, you know, he could hit it wild, but just dialed it in as a clinic when it mattered. And that's his biggest weapon. He's a great putter. He has a pretty underrated short game. Obviously, he's hitting it that close. But the driver, oh my goodness, just murdered the.
No chance. To anybody, we were lucky it was this close.
I thought on 17, like, he took like an extra beat, you know, and they said it on the broadcast, like, this is really like the last spot of trouble. I mean, Kevin, you were there, the 17th tee, like, this is like his last really chance where he could get in trouble. There's a hazard, we just saw Tiger going it. And then he not only he took the perfect angle cut off, like took like right on a rope over the left half, caught the fairway as it come, you know, dog leg slight left back in, you know, it was just perfect. There was no crack anywhere to be found. Even after that front nine hole, there was just no crack. And it was just the juxtaposition between Tiger kind of blowing one off the planet, right? And then them kind of, it almost felt like the broadcast was like trying to like tease it for us, like jinx him into like it. Like this is really the last spot where you can get in trouble. And then it was the exact opposite.
I was honestly that at the time I was like, that's one of the best pressure drives that I've ever seen. Like because it was just hammered as hard as he swung at it. And there was just no doubt. And I just watched Tiger, you know, take 5 minutes to think about his drive on 17 before, like 5 minutes before, and kind of ran back to Brooks. And Tiger, you know, his had almost no chance. And Brooks was just dead nails. By the way, when Tiger's ball looked like it was in the water on 17, we were walking up and I was walking next to Michael Phelps, who I know a little bit. And I was like, hey, man, if this is in the water, do you think there's anybody around here who might be willing to swim the creek and get it out? And he's like, dude, I'm on it.
humble brag right. Right there.
KBB, name dropping old sources, Michael Phelps.
That drive Brooks had on 17 was kind of like DJ's on 18 at Oakmont.
Yeah. That's a good point.
It's a good comparison. What was more impressive? I mean, I thought the shot into 16, though. I mean, it's like hard to choose. I don't know what was more. The shot into 16 from what, 230, 232 to 16?
I think it was
246.
Like
248.
248.
Oh,
God.
I mean, that
was 6 feet.
That was the official yardage of the hole, I think 248, and he hit it, according to the shot tracker, like 247 or something. So it might have been back all the way at 250 something.
That was an unbelievable shot. Like, one of the best shots I've ever seen in my life.
I mean, I was talking to his caddy afterwards, and he was just like, it was just a freaking laser. I mean, it just never left the pin.
It literally, like, they had the shot tracer on it, and I don't think it moved. Like, it was a straight rope. Like, that's the thing I think is, like, when I remember this, I mean, and I think we saw the same thing at Erin Hills, and to a degree at Shinnecock, like the guy just, I mean, he's unbelievable. Like it, not just the driving, but the putting, like the putts go in the dead center of the hole and they like are the perfect speed. And you're really surprised when he misses, like you're surprised when he misses a tee shot, you're surprised when he misses putts. And that doesn't happen with many guys down the stretch. Like,
yeah,
I was waiting for like Adam Scott. You know, I love Adam Scott, great player, but like you kind of sat and you were waiting for him to kind of fall apart versus like Brooks. I was just like, you know, is he going to miss any putts like that? Like you're almost praying for a miss. So it was close.
Yeah, I wrote this in my column, but like, what if like Brooks is like our Greg Norman, except instead of wilting in the big moments, he like just. It steps on people's throats. Like there's a lot of similarities. Like they're like young and stronger than everyone. They're both fitness freaks. They're both like generational drivers of the golf ball, but Brooks might have the one thing that Norman didn't, which is just that he's a killer closer.
Yeah. They have their own logo.
That is also true.
Brooks has his nifty little BK.
Dated a lot of like beautiful women. BK. Fast cars. I mean, kind of gruff and arrogant a little bit, off-putting to some people. I like it.
The poll question that Philip Johnson tweeted last night was great. Like, it's an unbelievable question. Like, better, like, whose career would you rather have, Brooks or DJ right now?
I mean, I don't know. I think, honestly, that's I would rather have Brooks's, even though it's a, you know, it's probably unfair, but like this is history is how, if you want to be remembered, if you want to have like a legacy, then majors are what it is. Does anyone really care that DJ won Kapalua or DJ won in Memphis like 20 years from now? No. They're going to be like, that dude has one or two majors, and that seems like a, you know, not very much for someone who might be the most talented player that ever lived. And so the fact that Brooks just has that kind of extra gear that makes him not care. I mean, it's, we were talking about this last night and we were kind of joking, but like Sean Martin's take about DJ is like the best take of all time, that he, the only major he's ever won is the one that he didn't know his own score. That's like so, that so nails as to what maybe DJ is. Like he maybe DJ isn't like the ice cold sort of chill dude that we all kind of presume he is, and maybe he does get a little bit nervy when he's around the lead, and this is, Brooks is proving to be the opposite.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to see what's the spread, like 7 years, maybe 7-6 years. Yeah, age, it's kind of, yeah. So these are like Brooks is in the same spot DJ was at whatever Whistling Straits or Pebble Beach or all those like major chances that he had late and didn't really close, and Brooks is actually closing them. Now, I'm trying to think of, like, when you were talking about what we, unfortunately, we define careers by majors, and Brooks has three, and DJ has one, and Brooks has, you know, 6 years down, you know, more to go behind him. I just think, like, trying to think of the analog for DJ, like, someone who, like, when you were there in the moment, you, like, I mean, it was just like erotic to watch. It was like amazing. It was arousing. But like then kind of like the 30-year view down the road was, it's listening to the old man tell you about how good he was to watch, even though he had five less majors than, is it like a Weisskopf or somebody like that? I don't know who that would be in the moment, but you know, we love it. And like we can appreciate it and we'll be able to talk about it 30 years down the road. But if he has just like one or two majors, and you know, 40 wins, and Brooks has 7 or 8 majors and 15 wins, 20 wins, like, we are going to hold Brooks's career in higher esteem.
Yeah, the financial things, one person tweeted like $70 million to like $20 million. It's like
DJ?
From the financial sense, there's no question what you would want, but from a legacy sense, I mean, three majors.
But DJ's also been a pro, you know, 7-8 years longer. I don't know.
I look at it, hey, if they both retire tomorrow, whose is it? You know, that's the way I think you have to approach these. And like when I post, everybody's like, you know, terrible. I said something about Hall of Fame, like, and I meant it in the context of like Brooks retires tomorrow, he's in the Hall of Fame, which is nuts. Like I didn't realize that was the case with Brooks before this tournament, watching it yesterday until like, even until like a couple hours later, I was like, holy cow, he's a major champ. He's a Hall of Famer.
I mean, he was a Hall of Famer before he won that. No, am I crazy? Like, this isn't like Cooperstown. We don't have these like old crusty writers, you know, pissed off at the world and happy to just put no one on their ballot. It's like, just like an open door policy. I think he was in the Hall of Fame before last year.
Brooks is totally going to pull a T.O., though, if he doesn't get like the Hall of Fame and have his own ceremony with, like, Mick Ultra in, like, a bar somewhere.
Going to go to, like, the Panhandle or something. And, like,
yeah, it's just for my haters. So.
But Fred Couples is in the Hall of Fame with one major, right? Yeah. I mean, what else does he have?
He has, like, we have 15 wins or something like that?
I know he has a lot of PGA Tour wins.
Here's another question. What is one major equal in PGA Tour wins? Like, what's the ratio?
I don't think
it's... I like 7 or 8, at least.
Yeah.
Because, like, John Daly has, what, like, 4 career wins and, like, 2 are majors, and he's not in the Hall of Fame. Some of that is like because of John Daly's like a circus act, but like, so I'm not sure you can just win 2 majors and get in the Hall of Fame. But this, at some point, like if you win 3, you're just in. Like, there's no real debate about it. It'd be like winning 21, you know, PGA Tour titles.
Monty's in the Hall of Fame.
Monty is in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah. You may, I guess he's 5 got a little wins.
Monty has won a lot of European majors.
A lot of wins. Yeah, a lot of. Yeah.
So Tiger.
Well, yeah.
I mean, Tiger solidified that he is the Rock from KVV's earlier take.
Yes, Mail.
Because if Tiger's not in this thing, it's the 2017 U.S. Open.
That is correct. No one, like, the emotional, like, Adam Scott is playing for Jared Lau thing is maybe a storyline, but there's not the, like, bonkers crowds. So, yeah, the Rock take turned out to be pretty good. Rock came back, and he's getting the all his little fans and out there getting going nuts. And I don't know.
Like, to a certain degree, it was the 2017 U.S. Open where Brooks just, like, there was some hope, but then he just really put it away. And he put it to bed, but the hysteria of Tiger just, like, clouded that it was actually kind of, you know, there wasn't a lot of drama.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, Tiger made the drama by shooting 64, but he didn't ever really have a chance.
It's funny how Tiger, like, makes everything okay, because, like, think of if Aaron Hills had happened when everyone was kind of like, ugh, Aaron Hills, what a bad U.S. Open. If Tiger had been second instead of JT or whatever in that U.S. Open, people would have been like, well, that was great. We got to go back to Aaron Hills, man. Like, even though Koepka won, like, Tiger made it interesting. No one would have complained about the score if Tiger was involved in that.
Well, I kind of wrote this morning, like, Tiger is the only one that can Tiger is the only one that can make something dramatic, you know, separate and apart from the outcome. You know, we don't need him to win for him to, like, be the show, obviously, and to provide the most dramatic moments of the day. It's like, it was never like that in his career. Like, his career was all about outcomes. His career was like, I show up to win a tournament. It feels like this season, and definitely yesterday, that changed. He knew he didn't win on 18 when he fist pumped and started smiling and waving to the crowd. He knew, you know, he hadn't won when he hung around the locker room and, you know, hugged. Like, it just feels a little different. Like, he feels like there's reward in playing and putting on the show like he did yesterday, and not just reward in, you know, not this kind of, like, black and white world of win versus loss. And, like, obviously he's the only kind of person that could be the show while losing by two shots, or, you know, never while Brooks kind of really, like you've said, Andy, never really had anything in doubt, left it in doubt over the last two and a half hours of the broadcast. Like, Tiger is obviously the only person who can steal that show. And I think it comes clearly in the context of not getting that for 2 years, not thinking we ever would.
He seems happier to me. I think that's not a made up projected sort of take, that he is genuinely, like, Kyle talked about this a little bit yesterday, but I think he's talked about it on the No Laying Up pod. But there was a moment on Saturday when Tiger just roped an awesome stinger, I think, on, like, 11. And he just kind of went over, and people were going nuts. And he put his club in his bag, and he just sort of smiled like he was taking it all in. And I think what's kind of neat about watching this sort of version of Tiger 4.0 is that he's able to sort of enjoy and appreciate things a little bit. He still gets really pissed when he hits a drive, you know, that stinks. But, like, he wasn't, you know, a salty dick after the round about, you know, like, or he didn't make an excuse about anything. And he just was kind of like, hey, you know, like, I played really well, and obviously I needed a great round, wasn't quite enough. And, you know, was there to hug Brooks and maybe kind of flirt with his girlfriend a little bit. And that was, that was classic new Tiger.
My favorite tweet was that there's, like, someone got the screen cap of, like, the eyes locking. It's like, she's one yacht invite away from leaving. Maybe slightly inappropriate, but the faith, you know, that's what the internet's for.
That's right.
Yeah, I think that's maybe this is the value of this, like, sunset phase of Tiger's career. Is, like, you know, maybe he wins, you know, once out of every 50, 60 times or something, you know, 50 times, let's say. Yeah. Or, yeah, once out of every 30 starts. Whereas, as opposed to once out of every
four, five.
But he's, like, okay with that and understands the value to him, value and reward both for himself and for the game and the crowd, and just shooting a Sunday 64 that results in a two shot loss. Like, I think he really understands and appreciates that. And he wouldn't 10 years ago. He wouldn't 15 years ago. He wouldn't care. It's like, it doesn't matter. I lost. Yeah. And maybe that's the real impact of this last phase of his career, that The game can be dependent from outcome.
It's his lowest score ever on a Sunday in a major. Yeah. I predicted that in the middle of the round to Kyle. I was like, I think this is going to be the lowest he's ever shot since Bob. Like, it'll be lower than the 65 he shot against Bob May. And it was. I think he shot 65 against Bob May. I know Bob May shot 65.
I mean, he hit zero fairways on the front nine and shot 33.
32 on the front.
32. Fairways. Unbelievable. I mean, that was one of the most ridiculous nines I've ever seen in my life. Like, when he made birdie on nine, I was like, what did I just watch?
Yeah, maybe the loudest roar I've ever heard. Like
nine?
Birdie on nine, yeah. It was crazy. People were going nuts.
He called it the most simple putt. It's just like this simple inside putt. The way that he got that, you know, that's for my money, one of those shots that's kind of part of the career retrospective highlight, the bender from the cart path. I know it was wet and soggy and the ball was sticking where it landed, but like he threw it to that kind of second tier. And the ball was going out of bounds. The ball was going OB. The drive was going OB. And then all of a sudden he's, you know, taking relief from the path and stuffing it on the back tier around the trees and, you know, off the junk. It's just, I mean, that's one that you add to the kind of the career retrospective. And I thought, you know, the darts at 3 and 15 sounded like the loudest. There were too many shots to choose, you know, and people are there's the backlash you always get when you talk about Tiger and not the winner. There's so much of that. I get the emails, the tweets, like Tiger didn't win. It doesn't matter. Like, and we can exaggerate Tiger, but as KVV just said, he shot the lowest final round in a major of his career. It is right and proper to talk as much as we are about him. We're not exaggerating this one.
He gained just a 3.8, so 4 shots approaching the greens, and he lost one off the tee. Like, he was 65th off the tee and first by almost a full shot approaching the green. Like, his approach shots were out of this world. I mean, that's what... Everybody talks about different aspects of Tiger's game, but Tiger was the best iron player in the world for so long. I think like a lot of stuff gets overblown, like driving the ball and the distance, but like always, like approach to the green, I think, is the single most important skill out there.
Yeah. I've joked about this a couple times, but if Rory was like, if they were playing in a shamble together and Rory just was job was to hit the drive, Tiger would have shot like 58 like 3 days in a row. I mean, Rory was playing from places that were unbelievable. I mean, he was hitting it 30 yards past JT every time and then hitting it into the bunker or hitting just kind of crap wedges or whatever. And Rory would be the first to tell you that his approach game was crap. But the way that Tiger's tempo was just so unbelievably good. You couldn't really couldn't explain it. I tried to ask him about it. He's like, yeah, you know, I just had like a legit club in every hole. I didn't have to have like a half club or bad yardage or just kind of the kind of golf nerd thing. But man, I want to like bottle that tempo and just like save it for him forever because it was so unbelievably good after he got it figured out. Think about this is like he was three over after two holes and that was the difference in the tournament in some ways for him. Like,
yeah.
Brooks got off to a horrible start though too. Both of them. Yeah. Both of them got like, what was Brooks? Brooks was a couple over through, you know, did he double his first hole of the tournament?
That's true. Yeah, he did. He had to claw back from it. So, yeah.
Do you remember when
he was two over through his first nine?
Huh. Do you guys remember Stevie used to say, like, this felt like one of those days when Stevie used to say Tiger would get so dialed in that sometimes he would force him to kind of aim a little away from the flag because he's hitting too much. You guys remember what he used to say?
That? He didn't want to hit the flag.
Yeah, he was hitting too many of the flags on the fly repeatedly.
Well, that's what like I ate him on 15 because I couldn't tell if Tiger was mad on 15, like, or if he was like pumped up there. And I thought maybe he had just hit it so good that it had hit the pin and kicked like way right or something. Instead, he was either like pumped up or he was mad they didn't dunk it.
This felt like one of those days that Stevie would like aim like you were too on. Like, just take, like, you know, just that a beat off so it bounces to 12 inches, doesn't hit the stick.
I would like to say that there's a guy that says that pros can't hit it where they aim. I like that.
I think pros are pretty good at hitting.
I think Tiger, if his caddy's having to aim him away from the flags, is hitting it where he's aimed.
You guys, so Kevin just talked about bottling that tempo. I guess I'd put this to Andy and Kevin. Do you think what we saw yesterday with the drivers just kind of how it is and how it's always going to be?
Well, like it's just the day before it was so fluid and so good.
Yeah.
Like the juxtaposition is like the beautiful like cut he hit off of 16 on Saturday, like versus the just like never had a chance. Like he missed it so big it was good on Sunday.
Yeah. I think that it's probably that's what's going to be like for from now on, that it's just I don't think he's ever going to get the driver figured out, but I wish that he would just basically do the Nicklaus thing where it's just like, you know what, I don't care what the shape of the hole is, I'm going to play a cut from now on, and that's what's going to be my sort of go-to thing, and that's I'm just going to shape everything. So even on like 13 at Augusta, either take it up over the trees or just say like, yeah, I'm just going to kind of flirt with the trees there and cut it back into the middle of the fairway or hit three wood, because he just, I don't know. He was still trying at times to kind of like turn it over and hit it. And I just don't think he can do that anymore with whatever's going on with this new swing. That's just not his, not going to be ever going to be his strength. And so can he win a major like with this new swing? Like, yeah, if it's a course where he doesn't have to hit that many drivers
or Augusta.
I went from being like thinking that he was going to be like a Ryder Cup liability to thinking like, man, play this guy an alternate shot. So he only has to hit like 3-4 drivers in a round and the other, you know, partner gets to hit the other ones. And his iron play is going to be unbelievable. He's all of a sudden looking like a great alternate shot player.
Especially with the Artiste.
That's right.
So did he hit so many drivers yesterday because he felt like he was behind, or just it didn't matter? That's just what the course demands. Whether you're in front or behind, you got to hit driver.
Well, I think it was soft too. Like it, you know, that iron just didn't chase. You know, it's zoysia, wet zoysia.
Yeah,
the approach shots from Koepka and who was he playing with? God, Scott on 8. Like they both hit like 2 amazing shots that just like hit 10 yards in front of the green and just stopped, you know, like low approaches into that par 5. And like, so if he hits that iron, it's flying 250, it's stopping at 250. It's a 7,400 yard golf course. Like he needed to hit driver.
Gotcha.
Something that I found, I mean, one of the most impressive things I thought just in general, like my takeaways, is Justin Thomas. Like he putted like crap all week. You know, he 45th in strokes gained putting and 56 strokes gained around the green. And like I almost feel like he had the best chance to win of anybody in the field.
Yeah.
10 under felt like the highest he could have shot.
Yeah. Like I mean, this guy, I think there's like almost like a clear class of player distinction right now with JT, DJ, and Koepka.
That sounds right.
I peeled off at one point from Tiger just because I was like, all right, I want to go watch a little bit of JT because I think he had gotten it to within a shot of Koepka. And I watched him miss the 7-footer or whatever on 9. Because he had sort of hit a bump and then he missed the comebacker and it was sort of over. I think he birdied the next hole after like hitting it off a guy's head. But man, like it was JT's going to be competitive in every PGA, I think, forever. I mean, he and Koepka might just trade PGAs back and forth for a long time.
It's like this. There's a recipe and Tiger created this recipe. And, you know, with technology, it's kind of evolved into this game. It's can drive it far and straight, become unbelievably good with your short irons and wedges, and putt the living daylights out. Like last week, JT putted, was lights out with the putter, and Koepka couldn't make anything at Firestone. This week, Koepka made putts and JT didn't make putts, and that was the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really felt like JT should have won. I mean, he's six strokes behind, but he just seemed chuffed. Or no, I'm sorry, pissed at the end of the day. You know, he seemed really, really pissed. Like, I cannot believe I'm only 10 under.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of gave away some shots down the stretch. You could once he missed that short one on was it 14 or 13? He missed a second short putt, and that to me kind of was like he knew he had no shot there. It always goes back to that margin, like to win is just so small. Like, is it the same? You saw the same thing with Scott on 17 when he missed that putt. You know, then he makes a bogey on 18. Like, you know, you could tell like on his face after he missed that putt on 17, he knew that was his chance because it would have been one shot going into 18, but he missed that 6-footer, just slides off, and it's like, man, it's over. And that's like one of the hardest things I think with golf. It's like, you know, once you know you missed your opportunity, because that's like the smallest, you know, it's the smallest thing. And for Adam Scott, it has to be, you know, devastating. You wonder how many is this his last real major chance?
Yeah, I felt, you know, I don't know what Adam Scott was thinking with the two putters deal. I mean, Brendan and I were joking the night before because I saw him on the putting green with the short putter, and I guess they were showing it on Golf Channel too. And I was like, this is nuts, man. You're like, you're in the final group of major and you're trying to think about a putter change the night before. And I guess Duvall was like going on say TV being like, oh yeah, I'm sure it's just a drill or whatever. But then he shows up with two putters like the next day and he's got them both in the bag. And it's like, oh yeah, I'm going to use the short putter, but on short putts, I'm going to use the long putter. Well, at what point do you decide this is a long putt versus short putt? Like, is it 10 feet, 20 feet? Do you look in your green reading book and decide, like, all right, outside this shaded area, that's going to be a long putt and this is going to be a short putt? Like, I don't think you can have that kind of indecision. And, I mean, like, Adam Scott legitimately still had a chance. Like, he could have hit the last two. He hit a bad drive on 17, but he managed to lay up pretty well and then hit a pretty, you know, to 6 feet. And he spent forever looking over that putt. And then he just hit a normal kind of Adam Scott putt, which he just didn't either read it right or hit it hard enough. So,
yeah, I think we tend to view Adam Scott as just kind of emotionless. He's like this, you know, good looking guy and with the perfect swing, and kind of he doesn't, outside of the fist pump of the Masters, we don't see him kind of react or emote in one way or the other too often. He has some kind of searing quotes for the USGA every now and then, but like he's just pretty kind of steady all the time. I thought you could read and see that he was pretty devastated. Like they, in between all the stuff about Brooks and Tiger, like they showed him in scoring and he just kind of looked spent, exhausted and crushed. And I think one of the Aussie writers wrote that he was legitimately like devastated by the loss. And the fact that we're talking about a guy with two putters in his bag, you know, that close and that, you know, devastated about not winning is kind of a testament to all the other parts of his game.
It was
he had a great tweet. It was like he brought two knives to a gunfight.
the emotions. I won't ever forget his face. Like that might be a lasting image for me. Is like of his career is his face when that putt slid off on 17. That's what his career kind of. When you think about his long-term scope is like it's going to be a lot of close calls.
Yeah. I just think it's so hard to get into contention at a major. It's like when you let one slip away, it's like the Sisyphus thing. You're sliding all the way back down the mountain. If every time Rory doesn't win a Masters, it's like you have to wait an entire year just to try to get back into contention. And that's what's so like devastating, I think, when you let a major slip away. It's just like, God, how am I going to put in all the work just to get back to this moment, just to have another chance, much less to win another one of these?
And so, it's a different one than like the Thomas Peters lighting it up. Like Adam Scott's contention was like real, like really in it. Let's take a quick break here to talk about our PGA Championship sponsor, Greater Than. After a long, hot day in St. Louis this week, I drove back to Chicago. I got home and was jonesing for a Greater Than, and I opened my fridge and found that Mrs. Fried Egg had drank them all while I was gone. She loves it, I love it, and I think you'll love it too. It's healthy, delicious, and hydrating. All you gotta do is give it a try, and I think you'll be hooked. Purchase it at drinkgt.com and use the promo code THEFRIEDEGG with no spaces for 20% off your first order. That's drinkgt.com. Now back to the pod.
So, Andy, on that topic, I would say, you know, we heard a lot about the leaderboard and how great it was. Would, you know, Adam Scott has not been good since really, you know, the beginning of 2017. Thomas Peters has not been good this year. Shane Lowry has been not good this year. He switched caddies. You know, his caddy, I think, fired him in between, you know, the first and second round at the Open. Like, he's not, and he's battling to make the FedEx Cup. Like, Lowry, Peters, like, there were names of guys who've not played well on the leaderboard as well. Does that say something about the venue?
So,
or no?
I think these guys can turn it around on a dime. Sure. Like, we see it all the time. Like, Gary Woodland hasn't been playing well, played really well this week. But that being said, like, I think the course kept more guys in it. Because in it's a common, it's not all the course. It's part of it was the conditioning, like how soft it was. Like, it didn't, to me, I'll think about this and think Brooks, it shouldn't have been as close as it was on Sunday with as many people as there were. Mm-hmm. But I think the guy that won was supposed to win, you know? So in a sense, like, so something that's interesting, and you know, I've been talking with Big Data Golf, getting in with Big Data. So nice. Saturday's round at Belle Reve had the lowest standard deviation of any major championship round in the last 10 years, and any PGA Tour round this entire season. So like the lowest kind of fluctuation of scores. So to me, like it seemed like Belle Reve was a course that was really pretty easy to shoot around even par and really hard to shoot really low, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. So what it did is it didn't allow for big separation. You know, I think it's like a course, like we see it with Augusta almost every year is where the leaders kind of really separate the class. And it's a smaller field, so that goes into it. But you know, Brooks, either way, like Shinnecock, for example, was the biggest standard deviation of any major or any tournament this year, which comes as no surprise also. But, you know, when we look at it, like the venue kept a lot of people. But is that good? You know, like it was an exciting leaderboard because of how many people were in it.
Yeah.
You know, the question is like, was like, do you want the great players of the week to separate themselves?
Yeah. I was wondering if the PGA's brand ought to be like not only boring courses, but just water the heck out of them so that they're really wet everywhere, and they should just completely dump water on anything they can so that it'll more likely the good players are able to rise to the top of the leaderboard.
There was my mentions this week was a dark, yeah. It was a very dark place. I mean, like, I think people have this mentality of like that, like I was like just watching golf in anger the whole week. And it's like, I like love watching golf, like, you know, and like, I think there's like an irony, like, you know, I've played amateur golf my whole life. And like the courses I hate as like a architecture aficionado are the courses I enjoy playing tournament golf at the most, because yeah. like they fit my skill set the best. Like I hit the ball straight and far when I play well, like, yeah. and I'm an average putter. So I like playing somewhere which like gets rid of half the field, and everybody after round one, look at all the variety. Like there was no variety. Every player played the exact same style of play down the stretch. Like it was all like bombers. Like, you know, they're the best players in the world. Like it got the best players of the world at the top, but like none of the guys in the top 10 are short hitters. Like someone's like Molinari's short. It's like Molinari hits it like 305 on average. Like that's not short. Yeah. So to me, like at the end of the day, like, the tournament unfolded exactly how we said it was going to unfold before. Like, the bombers are, it was going to be bombers, and like, Brooks Koepka was like the best bomber, you know?
Yeah. Who's so, like the shortest hitter on the top 25 of that leaderboard?
Shea Reve. Shea Reve, who led the field in strokes gained approach, or second in strokes gained approach. So he was, you know, it took a career performance with his irons to get him there. Like,
sometimes when you think about like how to explain to people like what makes it like a different kind of venue that you can play different styles and be competitive, like, I think you think about like the 2015 like British Open. I'm like, think about that leaderboard. Zach Johnson wins, but like Jason Day almost, you know, was like right there. Spieth was right there. Leishman was there. DJ dominated the first 2 days. Like, those are guys who are playing a different golf course, each of them. And they're all able to be competitive because you just play to your style. And that's part of the reason why the old course is great.
Yeah, it goes to variety.
Yeah.
You know, everything.
And both things can be true. You can have a good tournament and a good leaderboard, and the venue still stink and boring golf. I mean, the players said it themselves. Like, Andy, you don't need to defend the players. You don't need to defend yourself. The players said it as much. It's all right in front of you. There is no strategy. Pat Perez was hilarious. He goes, I mean, I don't want to say there's no strategy, but, you know, yeah, I mean, you just kind of hit it as far as you can, hit it on the green and putt. And there's he like walked himself down an alley and didn't know how to get out. It was great. The players said it.
They didn't even play practice rounds.
Yeah, you don't need to practice. You don't need to scout it. You hit it as far as you can, and there's not a lot to the green.
Tiger never saw the first 7, 8, 9 until he played them on Thursday. That's how like not strategy important it was. He was playing them blind. Like, literally, he just didn't play them.
These are the three truths. There wasn't strategy involved, and that's fine. The leaderboard and the championship were still exciting. And three, they spent a ton of money to dye their cart paths brown.
From what I hear, that Bellerive is going to be a different course here pretty soon. So,
really?
Yeah. I think like one of the things, like, I think like...
Is Reese going to get another crack at it?
No. Sounds like they're going in a different direction.
Okay. Is there another Jones, like some like 30-year-old Jones? Like, just kind of.
I think that actually Trent works for RTJ too.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I hear he's a really nice guy. So
yeah, okay. we don't
need to. I'm sure the Jones family is all really nice. So people are like getting this, like, a lot of this the wrong way. Is that like somehow in some of these discussions that we don't like these people or we think they're bad people? Like, if you put something out there, if you make art, you have to sort of be willing to have it, you know, be critiqued. And I think that Andy's always really fair in his critiques. And so this idea that all these St. Louis people thought that somehow he was shitting on St. Louis was just silly. Like, Andy and I played one of the, I think, the funnest courses in the whole country on Tuesday in St. Louis and couldn't say enough nice things about it. And seeing the difference between the two was obvious once you stepped on the Bellerive property.
I think one of my like my problems with just in general is like what happens is that this week people watch this and they say, hey, this is what, and just in general is what happens is the American public and the golf, it thinks that this is what great golf is.
Yeah.
Like in general, like the golf, this is what a great golf course is. And that's where I think the struggle is, and it's one of the biggest struggles of American golf is that people can't play the greatest golf courses in America.
Yeah.
Like, they're the most exclusive places. And for the most part, like a trip to Bandon or a trip to Stream Song or Sand Valley, like that's a once in a lifetime trip for most people. And that's kind of the underlying issue is like, people go, they see Bellerive and they think this hard style of golf is the best golf. But like, you know, St. Louis Country Club is like one of the most fun golf courses in the Midwest and one of my favorite. Yep. But unfortunately, not a lot of people are going to ever see that. And it's this type of golf, like a good example is like these guys, so it's 7,400 yards, and these guys shot 264, Brooks shot. And Trinity, yeah. For example, Trinity Forest, Aaron Wise shot 261, and they softened the course, slowed it down, played it shorter than it really is to like make sure the players were happy there. Like, this isn't hard golf for the modern era. That's the thing. That's like my biggest point, is that this golf course, like, it can be a major championship host. That's fine. It can, like, we can have a great tournament at it because these are the best players in the world, but it's not a great golf course because, like, it's completely unplayable for like an 18 handicap, and it's not even hard for a great player. Like, it's an easy golf course. We saw it this week, and what on the back half of it is like Trinity Forest is a joy to play for an 18 handicap, and it's still really hard for a pro. Like, or still like it's as difficult for a pro as Belle Rivas. So like, you have these two ends of the spectrum, and it's just this type of penal golf design is bad. You know, it wasn't good for the golf in America. That's more the overarching point. You know, you can have great tournament golf at a bad golf course because, you know, Tiger, like, Jesus, the guy made the golf tournament.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple guys had putts for 62, and it was like no one really even cared. It like wasn't, no one was like, oh my gosh, I'm watching the greatest round in history. It was just, no, like, this course was super gettable. So, I mean, I'm sure that it would have been a little different had it been dry, but when is it ever going to be dry in August here in St. Louis? Like, this, you get the course that you get when this time of the year. So, I don't know. That Brooks was like, oh, I think they should bring a Ryder Cup here. I don't know. I mean, the fans are going to be, Ryder Cups and courses are generally kind of like this, where it's not like it's all that interesting. It's a Hazeltine or Valhalla or whatever. So
Whistling Straight.
That's a perfect example of, like, you know, golf and competitive golf has the ability to upstage a golf course. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that's like, you know, the golf course, dismissing that a golf course doesn't matter, though, is extremely short-sighted. Like, you know, like, golf courses do play a role. It'd be like saying, like, hey, it doesn't matter if, you know, we're going to have the Cubs and the Red Sox in the World Series, but it doesn't matter if they play at Wrigley and Fenway. We're going to play it at minor league stadiums instead. Mm-hmm. You know, like, the golf course plays like a significant role in a championship. Like, saying it doesn't matter, and I am no way was saying it's the only thing that matters. Like, I've never said that, and that's what people think I said, you know?
So what, that being said, I guess you probably weighed things differently. What was the best major this year? With eliminating recency bias. I don't know. I mean,
I think Carnoustie was better.
Yeah, I was thinking about it last night. I was like, God, I think that might have been the best major this year. It was like, it also just finished, and I'm like coming off the high of it, you know, as opposed to, and you know, the others are more distant memories. I don't know.
Pretty fun majors overall this year, though. You know, Spieth's crazy run on Sunday and Reed holding off everyone and basically giving a middle finger to all his haters and maybe some of his family. And you have, you know, a world-class venue in Shinnecock, you know, one of the five best courses in the world. You got a Tiger getting in the mix at Carnoustie and Spieth almost like rescuing a terrible year and then completely, you know, Molinari coming out of nowhere. And then this one, like a pretty awesome year of majors, like no clunkers or stinkers.
I think the most memorable one when we look back 10 years from now will be maybe the U.S. Open because of A, Phil, and B, the course.
Like, yeah.
Like, it's crazy, but like
that's right. I mean, we think about 2004 and we first think about the Verdant, you know, number seven. You know, we don't remember. We know Goosen won, but we don't remember specific shots. We just know the USGA effed it up. You know, that it's weird the things we kind of, you know, extract from a full season of majors.
How about Phil? Let's use that as a segue to talk about, like, he's going to be on the Ryder Cup team, I think, but it's not really the best thing for the U.S. right now.
Yeah, it sounds like he's going to be on the Ryder Cup team, and I don't know. I heard people lobbying for like, or I don't know, guessing that he's also going to, you know, bring his own captain's pick with him, which would be Kevin Kisner. It's like, and that may be right, but I wonder that, like, if that's like, if he should have that kind of power at this particular moment.
If Tiger gets to bring Bryson and Phil gets to bring Kisner, like, isn't Furyk just basically getting cucked, like, on his own? Like, Furyk got to stand up for himself and be like, look, if I want to bring Tony Finau, I'm bringing Tony Finau. You guys can be the captains when you're the day captain.
They're kind of stuck with Tiger and Phil for, like, I don't think you're stuck with Tiger after recently, but like, I feel like you're stuck with Phil forever. That's the problem with the American team. Like, I could see the Europeans not putting Sergio on the team. I don't know if it'll not happen, but I feel like, you know, Sergio, like, if he doesn't get picked, he'll be like, oh yeah, I didn't play well enough. Like,
ooh, I don't know about that. I can see Sergio throwing a huge like tantrum about, I would love it if Sergio was basically like, look, my form is not there. I need to go and, you know, like basically be a vice captain. Like, Sergio should take on that role because he's going to be a great Ryder Cup captain someday. But Sergio's also super proud and is going to say, look, no one's been a better Ryder Cupper than me other than Seve essentially for a long time. And I deserve the chance to see if I can sort of find my form in there. I mean, Bjorn might not see it the same way, but Sergio has not exactly been someone who like shows a, he's obviously a different person now than he was when he was younger, but I could see some of that old kind of Sergio pride coming out and saying like, come on, man. Like I made the Ryder Cup team in Europe for these people.
Hey,
everything I gathered was that Bjorn is putting him on there. It doesn't matter.
I don't know.
What, you know who led the PGA in birdies?
Finau?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm telling you, he's going to be a great four ball player if they just put him on the team. Like,
That's the thing that I find sad is like, that's what bugs me is like, you know, like Phil, I get why Phil, like Phil is a ratings guy. He sells tickets. He like attracts the casual golf fan. I don't think he has as big of an impact as people think, but he is a needle mover and he moves it like a tenth of a fraction. I don't think that's possible since a fraction is it, but that Tiger does. But he like moves the needle. But like Tony Finau should be on the team.
Yeah, here's the thing. We talk so much about the captain's picks right after the auto points close that like, these things change so much, I think more than we remember in the like 3 to 4 weeks before the picks are made. Like Ryan Moore was just not involved in this point, 2016. Billy Horschel was not even like anywhere on the radar in 2014. Like I think there's somebody outside of that group that I'm sorry, could win at Wyndham or could win, you know, Wyndham Philly or Wyndham Jersey, you know, somewhere, one of the two legs. I think it just, there's the ability to really force Furyk's hand. You know, we think the universe is pretty limited, but sometimes, you know, there's guys that come from outside that, you know, that small group of four or five guys we think we have to pick from.
Who are the vice captains going to be for Furyk, if assuming that Phil and Tiger are on the team? Is it besides Stricker, I assume, since he's going to be the captain and whistling, but like, who else is there? I mean, honestly, the ideal scenario for me is that they put Finau and Kisner on the team, and at this point, Phil and Cooch are like vice captains. Like,
yeah, Cooch
might deserve to be a Ryder Cup captain someday, so put him in the mix of like vice captainships.
Zach Johnson might be a pick too. He might be a captain's pick.
Yeah.
Oh God, we don't need to reprise that. Somebody come down that road.
Somebody made a point though. He's a good fit for this course. There's tons of water. He drives it straight and he wedges it well.
That's Furyk. Remember when Furyk was like, he wouldn't rule himself out as like a potential player forever? He's like, well, you know, if I had been healthy the whole time, and we all thought that that Love was going to pick him as part of the buddy system until Furyk, I think, kind of basically took himself out of the mix. Like, this generation, like, really sticks up for one another. And I don't know that they're going to quite, even if someone wins, I don't know that they're going to say, he's done it before. Let's take Kuchar.
Yeah, it's amazing how much like we forget political capital matters for these things. Like there's a group that runs. I was watching TV last night and David Duval was talking about the Ryder Cup and I was like, why hasn't he been a captain? You know, why hasn't he been like? And Azinger like references, I think, on either Shane Bacon's pod or I don't know NLU about how like there is a specific clique that's running the whole operation now. He's not a part of it, you know. He did his thing, but like. There are these cliques that run the whole thing, and you know it gets political. And I don't know, it was just weird how things change. Watching Duval, I was like, he won a major. Furyk won one major. Duval had probably a better career than Furyk, maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But like, it's just weird how we decide who's in the group and who's not.
The Furyk Duval debate's interesting because like, do you? This is my Ernie Phil take. This is the same thing, like. Do you like Phil's longevity into his like late 40s trumps Ernie, but Ernie in his 30s was like way better than Phil, like prime versus prime. Sure. Like the other thing, Phil didn't win a major till the Pro V1 came out. Like Ernie won when it was a game that had more skill. This is, but the Duval thing is a shorter career, but much more dominant career. Than Furyk, but Furyk's was longer sustained success.
I feel like you have to if you go into television stuff, I think it becomes a little bit harder to become a part of the Ryder Cup clique because you have to do television well. You have to be critical of players, and so then all of a sudden, like it's like Phil like lashing out at Brandel in that Shipnuck piece. Like Phil expects, he's like, oh, I think everyone should, it should be the job of the people to lift up golf instead of tear other people down. Well, you know, that's not an analyst's job. An analyst should be like tethered to the truth, not to like boosting the game. And so I don't, obviously Duval, he hasn't been in that TV that long, but he probably in choosing that path in some ways makes it hard for him to ever really get back into it. If he was tomorrow, like, I really want to be a Ryder Cup captain, I think they'd be like, oh, well. That's not happening.
It also goes into playing in Ryder Cups late in your career. Longevity bridges it. Like, because, like, you know, Duval, somebody might say, oh, he doesn't really understand the modern game, you know, because he's not around he's not around the guys all the time. When you're 40, when you're 46 and still playing on tour at a competitive level, like, you know, these guys and there's that camaraderie. You know, it's the same reason that, you know, Kuchar, I still think he's going to get picked because he's a great team room guy.
Yeah. He's also malleable. He will play with anyone. Like, he will play with Bubba, and then he will play with DJ. Like, he just plays with – he doesn't mind playing with anybody. That is an asset. I mean,
here's a hypothetical. Like, what if Stuart Sink had out-battled Tiger down the stretch and been, like, the guy that, like – disrupted that won two majors over like the greatest story in sports two times. That was a distinct possibility.
The most innocent hated man of all time.
Stuart Sink's a good dude, and it was funny to hear him talk about. They were asking like, "What was it like to play with Tiger?" And he was like, "Man, I played with Tiger a lot back in the day. I mean, a lot. Like, I remember a lot of Sundays where." He didn't quite say it, but you could tell he was like mentally clicking, like, I just got dusted. And it was similar to that. And so it's like Stuart Sink like came to the microphone that day with like the perspective of a guy who's seen some shit. And they're like the current generation just now figuring out like what it was like to play with bonkers crowds and people moving every time you hit your shot and no one cheering for you and stuff. It was like, I wanted to sit there and hear Sink tell Tiger, like playing with Tiger stories for 10 minutes.
It's kind of a shame that, I don't know. It's like, I don't know. I would have loved to have JT in that like Tiger group on Sunday. Yeah. You know, like Gary Woodland's a great player. He's a really good PGA Tour pro, but like what Gary's experience on Sunday was unlike anything anybody else felt. And like, it would have been such a like to have JT making that run like that he made in the middle of the round with Tiger. Like, I mean, that would have been unbelievable.
Yeah. it would have been cool. JT would have definitely embraced it. It was funny, like, JT, they were like showing Tiger like highlights on the board when JT was like trying to make birdies, and even he was kind of joking about how that was pretty freaking cool to like be in the mix with Tiger in a tournament, you know, in a major. So
Tiger has like the straight up yips off the tee.
Oof, yeah. Man. True. I mean, it's
the iron he hit on 13 was like a shank.
Yeah.
Like, he missed the fairway by like 30 yards. I'm just thinking back in my head.
Like it was unbelievable to see him like hit an iron on Sunday or whatever, and he's like, he would twirl it and like walk away, and it would like end up in the bunker. Like, even he wasn't, it was weird to see him not even like do the thing where he kind of holds it and gets pissed or whatever. I think some of those irons he thought he sort of stripped, and they were still missing fairways. It was bizarre.
It was something else. PGA, I mean, I feel like we're still in the same spot we were before the tournament. It was like it'll be one of the best PGAs of, you know, I mean, the best PGA of all time over the last 10 years before this one was Tiger Y.E. Yang.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that one, you know, sort of ended with a thud unless you were sort of pulling for the underdog. So I don't know. I think if we're ready to do overrated, underrated, I'm ready to say PGA, underrated.
I'll say this, and to make it extremely personal, I was happy I wasn't going, and now I have serious thought. Like, I'm pissed I didn't go. It looked sweet. But at the start of the week, I was like, oh, I am just quite happy and contented to sit fat and happy on my couch and watch this on TV. And I really wished I was there this weekend.
You were on a heater on Twitter all week, though. You had an excellent week on just with some great tweets, I gotta say.
Well, that's good. I mean, the most useless and least valuable skill in the world, I was doing it well.
I appreciate it.
The fact that I'm like driving distance away and didn't drive down, it kind of makes me sad.
Like, had a credential too. You wasn't just like, it wasn't like you had to buy a ticket. You could have walked within the ropes with and seen Tiger with us, and you decided to go have burritos instead. So.
But this is the one thing I will say. Like, I mean, nobody watched Brooks. Like, that's like, I think that's where, I mean, so here's an interesting thing with like the PGA is the PGA championship, to me, the more I think about it, seems to embrace the event, like, and going to the event, which, when you think about the future of golf and just sports in general, like, the event is becoming, like, going to the event's becoming less and less a part of the sport.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, I couldn't believe how big that merchandise tent was. Like, the amount of infrastructure you need to host a PGA championship is insane. Sure. Like,
yeah.
And that's like the reality. And like, to go to places like St. Louis, there's only one course that can host it. And to me, that's sure. Like, one of the biggest problems is that, like, with the way major championship golf is now and like the way they have to make money, like, the PGA made so much money this week, like, oh, so much money. Is that limits where you can go. I think there's only probably like 30 courses around the country that can feasibly host a major championship.
I mean, where are they going next? Go with Bethpage, Harding Park, Trump Bedminster's in there, which will be interesting. You know, it's a lot of like,
Oak Hill.
Yeah. Next three are Bethpage, Harding Park, Kiowa, and then Trump Bedminster, I think. That's the next four.
And
it's all big public courses, except for Trump's, I guess.
Yeah, like Trinity Forest is a great example. It can host a PGA Tour event, but it can't host a PGA.
Yeah.
It's not big enough. There's not enough space.
Ground, yeah.
You know what I was thinking about? You were talking about how much you hated the third hole. And I think the reason that had to play, like, 130 or 140 or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, God.
The back tees were covered by a corporate tent.
Oh, like, God. No.
Yeah.
They to accommodate the tents, they had to put them over it.
Right? Oh, no.
I literally, like, walked up to that hole. It makes so much more sense. Like, when I walked up to that hole, I was like, my God, this might be the worst short par three I've ever seen in my life. And, like, I got a lot of heat for, like, saying it was a horrible hole. But then I found out that, like, there's a tee, like, 170 yards out. And it makes so much more sense. It's, like, a legitimate hole. But, like, the way it was set up, it was, like, nobody made a bogey on a par three in a major championship. And I'm, like, the biggest par doesn't matter guy. But the only scores on the hole for the day were two or three. How is that even possible?
Wow. That is some good on-the-ground insight. That is kind of a farce. They put a tent over a tee box, you know. Well, that is the starkest example of how these things are kind of, these things are events.
They're, I mean, the 18th hole, Kyle and I were joking about this, but like the 18th hole was backed up against a road, and then like we're laughing about, like, thinking about Jim Nance, like, you know, calling like the sort of the majestic, like, and then there's trucks like driving by, like, and all the big semi-trailers that they had to set up were like, just, you could hear the generators like humming. Like, it was not exactly like the pristine sort of beautiful, you know, I'm sure Sebas hit it well in the cameras, but it looked like it was backed up against, you know, a construction site, essentially.
Yeah, you try to think of these, yeah, these majors. I'll never forget. You think these courses are like these bucolic classic setups. I'll never forget at Oakmont during a rain delay watching people pile in a porta potty to shield themselves from the rain. So it's filthy, like disgusting. It's just like,
oh, God.
These generators everywhere, these trucks everywhere. I mean, it's kind of like you can lose sight of the course. It's a big major sporting event.
I'm excited for the first no attendance golf tournament. And I don't know when it's going to happen, but I hope it's in like the next 5 years. Like,
no, I already have Tory when what's his name? When the weather delay meant that Schnedeker had to play in front of no crowds or whatever. That was the no attendance golf tournament.
I know. I'm saying nothing. No stands, no parking, no hospitality. You sell, like, you know, like, you think about the costs that go into it, and that's part of where all this, but like all the benefits for a sponsor are digital. I know that they have these like pro-am stuff, but like the digital benefits are all that matters in the modern world.
Yeah, I that's what it's going to have, our Hickory Club Championship at National Golf Links. That'll be the one where you have to hitchhike into National Golf Links, and no cell phones are allowed, and that's it.
I mean, Kiowa should be the one.
Yeah,
you know, players go out to the end of the island. You know, nobody else does. Nobody has to sit in that shuttle, which we still hear, you know, war stories about to this day. Mm-hmm. I mean, that should be the one.
Just, do you think
nothing
could,
out there.
I could book an Airbnb like now for that major? Like, yes. Hey, I want to rent this house like 4 years from now for this week.
Not for cheap.
All right, let's do overrated, underrated.
Alrighty.
Let's say St. Louis.
I'm going to say underrated. Yeah, I had some really good barbecue this week, and, you know, played an awesome course in St. Louis Country Club. And even though the fans were mean to me because I was making fun of the boring course in Belle Reve, I still enjoyed it. So underrated.
I don't know. I mean, I wasn't there, so I can't really speak to it. I'd say underrated, underrated. You know, I think they tend to puff their chest out about being great sports fans, which maybe it's deserved, but it sounds like from all accounts the players loved it. I kind of hate when you do those questions we did in DC, like, hey man, Tiger, what'd you think of the fans coming back to DC? Oh,
yeah, what are you
gonna,
gonna say?
What's he gonna say? They sucked. God, these guys are just assholes.
I need to have a quick rant about this. That is the most thirsty behavior ever by media people, and it drives me bonkers. And comes off as so small town and like provincial. And look, if they do it in Baltimore too, I'm sure if they did it, held a championship in Montana, the Montana media would do the same thing. But it just, like, in the final press conference when you got, you know, like, someone's asking Brooks Koepka, like, how awesome were the fans? Can you say, Brooks? Like, can you just say a few words about the St. Louis fans? Come on, that is not journalism. You're doing PR for the St. Louis, like, commerce chapter. Like, grow up and do real journalism, please.
I would like the one guy to just say, they're all right. I mean, I don't know. Maybe you guys will get another major. I'm not talking about St. Louis specifically. I'm just saying, generally, I would love for someone just to kind of, like, flip it around so that local newscast, you know, News Team 5 doesn't have their sound. Nope.
Koepka was our chance. Koepka, like, I don't know, man. It's fine. It's
another tournament. They asked, I guess Koepka's uncle played on the Cardinals and won the World Series with the Cardinals. Yeah. And they asked him about it, and Koepka was just like, yeah. I don't know. He, like, knew nothing. And it's like, how did you not expect that question? But St. Louis, as a Cubs fan, way overrated.
All right.
You know, as a Chicagoan. But they did a great job this week. I got to give credit where credit's due. They did a great job. It would only be better if it wasn't in August. It was so humid down there. But yeah, they did a great job. They deserve a golf course that can, you know, that's the sad thing is there's one golf course there that can host, you know?
Yeah.
And that is the reality of most cities, is that there's one golf course to host, and it's not the course you would most want to see the championship at.
Yeah.
So, underrated. Underrated for a championship. I think, like, the small town thing is underrated. I listened a lot of Nelly this week. That was awesome. You know, I think I listened to an hour of it last night. But
I definitely listened to the Country Grammar a couple times because Porras said it should be, like, you know, our national anthem. And so,
hot shit. when the bass comes on, it's
about. I always think about that, the beginning of EI, though. It's like, I'm a sucker for cornrows and manicured toes, Philly capri pants and parachute hose or something. Like, that's a great opening line.
What about, you couldn't hold me if your last name was Hand? You know?
Can I talk about the absurdity that Nelly and Tim McGraw did a duet? Pop the charts for like a year. We're gonna look back on that in 20 years, like, what? Nelly and Tim McGraw?
Yeah. I
was listening to Just a Dream last night. It's an older it's a later stage Nelly song, more R&B. But I legitimately was listening to it and I was like, man, this song's about Cat. You know, and it's like all about how he misses his girl and, like, he just wants her back. And, like, listening to it after what just happened, I was like, man, it's so good to have Kat back. Like, this is what I felt for, like, the last 5 years.
Yeah.
Overrated, underrated, Ricky Fowler.
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to say overrated. I mean, at this point, like, it was there for the taking. I know he was a little bit hurt, and that'll be the thing that everyone sort of says, you know, but how could you rip on Ricky? He was hurt. You know what? Everyone's kind of, like, a little bit hurt out there. Like, no one's 100% healthy. The guy with a fused back almost won this championship. At some point, Ricky, like, I think you need to sort of step up and win one of these. Everyone thinks you're a great guy, and you seem to be. But we're not. Brooks Koepka might not be a great guy. Might be winning championships. So championships are kind of what people are going to measure you on. So it's time to stop getting in the mix and not delivering a great round when it would give you a championship.
Yeah, I say overrated. Just not. Not a part of the battle. What did he shoot? 65, 67 to get to the. You were talking about. Aaron Hills last year, whoever, I think KVV brought it up.
Yeah.
It's just like another Sun. I was thinking, oh yeah, the analogy works because Ricky was there on that another Sunday where Ricky just was supposed to be a part of it and completely was ejected from the broadcast, you know, early in the round or it was the Open this year where he made a triple on six. It's just like, there's you can only you're when you're that close that many times and never like he's not even like a factor on the back nine on Sunday. We saw him at the Masters make kind of make the charge against Reed, but it's just he's overrated. I'm sorry. And until I tend to think we forget about how great he was closing that Players Championship. Yeah.
Like I think that great closings ever. I mean,
I think that deserves more weight. And like when we have these discussions about him coming up short in majors, I think we forget about it, quite honestly. But I'm going with overrated.
When I get together with the sports writers and reconfigure what the majors were retrospectively, like they did to my man Hagen, I'm just going to be like, well, that's a major. So Rick actually won a major there. Psych. Like,
what do you think?
You know. Curious. I always say that winning is overrated, and he finished second in the cumulative majors, best score, you know, again, like he was a factor in all of them, in a sense, a little bit, like a weekend, like US Open, maybe not, he kind of ejected hard, but like he was, every weekend he was in the mix, but like at the end of the day, has there ever been a major that we say, he should have won this. Like,
no.
I feel like, yeah. I mean, I feel like he should have won Aaron Hills. Like, he was a shot back of.
But I'm saying, right? It wasn't like on Sunday, this guy's going to win. Like, it's never been that. And, like, to me, it goes back to, like, he just doesn't win.
Yeah.
And hasn't won at a high rate. And tour events, so why are we expecting, like, he contends a lot, but like is he really contending?
I
think they're that's well put. I'm not gonna get into theory on why, but
like DJ, he has like three majors he should have won.
I think closing kick is a thing, like, it, you know, he obviously has it sometimes, like the fact that he didn't win the Masters might have just come down to Reed banging it off the pin instead of putting it off the green. But, you know, there's a lot of more instances of where if he had played like that, he would have won a major at this point. And he just kind of hasn't really done it. And I don't know. Eventually you are who you are. It's like that thing with the Parcells. You are what your record says you are. That's Rick.
Last question before we get out of here. This is going long, but most disappointing season. Major season.
Huh. Tiger, can't believe he didn't win one.
I would say DJ.
Yeah,
DJ should have won that US Open. I mean, if he had taken care of business on the weekend, Koepka never really would have had a chance. And he should have been in the mix here and backed up. You know, I don't know why he can't quite figure out Augusta. He's obviously a really good links player, too. I don't know. He's just, at some point now, DJ's 36, 34.
Older or younger.
More than one major. Like, he's as good of a player talent-wise as Koepka is. So I feel like DJ is my pick.
You know how Rory, Spieth, there's some candidates here.
JT.
But I tend to agree with DJ, with the DJ answer, because what you said earlier about Brooks, DJ, and JT really being kind of a separate class, I think that's true this year. Mm-hmm. I think Rory's searching. I think Spieth is searching. I think those three are not. I think they are kind of their own class just this year. I wouldn't argue, you know, I'm not arguing that Spieth and McIlroy aren't in that class or even in the class above them based on, you know, past results. But DJ should have delivered more than he did. There should have been a greater return on this season. I'm sorry. And that Saturday, when everyone's shooting, you know, there were everyone's shooting 65s, and there were only seven scores worse than his. He shot 72.
He was just 5 over through 14.
I think, like, between that, You know, missing the cut of Carnoose. I just, and the U.S. Open. I mean, Brooks just hip checked him off the course. I don't know. I think it's DJ based on the season he's had. He just didn't get the return he should have.
I'm going with Molinari. I can't believe he didn't defend us to go back to back majors. No, I would. I think Rory. I can't believe we're where we are with Rory.
Yeah.
Like,
but crazy though that, like, I mean, did he have a worse major season than Spieth? You know, I guess Spieth kind of Spieth essentially had a chance to win, you know, Carnoustie and could have won it by shooting even par that day. So I feel like Spieth's major season may be a little more disappointing than Rory's, even though he was in contention at Augusta.
Rory's Sunday at the Masters is gross. It's kind of almost inexcusable. But, I mean, I love the guy, but
the wedge, the short iron wedge play is just, I mean,
not good, Bob.
It's so Rory, Spieth, Brooks, DJ, JT, who ends their career with most majors?
I still say Spieth.
Yep.
Just because I think he's gonna play till he's 50 and be contending at every Masters and British Open for a long time. But you know, JT and Brooks, I think at this point I would put ahead of Rory right now.
Oh man,
I know it's hard for me to say that. It pains me to say that.
More than four, they're gonna get five. Yeah, Brooks certainly seems on his way to more than four, or at least four.
JT's got a long way to go to get.
Yeah,
I mean, that's, you know,
it's heavy lifting.
I think it's Spieth too. I think he has, you know, the most staying power. You know, he's going to be playing the Augusta well into his 40s or 50s. You know, unless he has like a crack up. One of my favorite things yesterday was when the ball was in the air at one of those holes. He goes, "I hope you're right, Michael." And it's like, oh man, I hope he is too. He might not be, might be thrown outside the ropes. Like he has those moments where you're like worried if he has like, if he's just going to have a mental breakdown. But yeah, I think he has the most staying power. And shoot, he's, even when a year he hasn't really had it and he was sick and not playing well, he contended late on Sunday at the Masters and late on Sunday at the Open. So I just think he's like a major championship player for the longest.
I'm either going JT or Brooks. I think I'm going, yeah, JT. I think JT, his learning curve is a little bit higher. Like it takes longer, but once he learns how to play Augusta, once he learned how to play links golf, it's,
yeah,
I mean, he's just so talented. I mean, his game, like from like a pure talent perspective, not, sure, maybe not talent, but skills, is like at a different level.
Yeah. You know? I think he loves the moment too. JT, like he wants to be in the arena.
Yeah.
Totally.
The shot he hit on 11's like going to be like one of the greatest forgotten shots. The punch where he killed the guy, where he hit him in, yeah, the head. Like, yeah, he hit like that punch runner up to like,
yeah,
that was an unbelievable shot. I mean, that will be one of the greatest shots that's forgotten from this tournament.
Sure.
So, all right. Thanks guys for coming on. That was fun. What a good major.
Great season. Thanks, Andy.
Hey.
You bet.
Later.
You've been listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. We do the digging for you.